Colin Bennett has written a fascinating new book. It's called Flying Saucers Over the White House, the inside story of Captain Edward J. Rappelt and his official U.S. Air Force investigation of UFOs back in sort of the golden era of at least American ufology, back before the big cover-up was instituted, before the cone of silence dropped over the whole subject, before disinformation was in place, and before lies became the official policy of our government and perhaps other governments around the world. We'll come back in just a moment and jump right into it with Colin Bennett. Stay here on Coast to Coast AM. You know, one of the side benefits of being the host of this program is the interesting people, the keen minds that you get to meet as a result of being in this chair. It is my pleasure to be on a small but influential email list. Jack Sarfatti, the physicist, renegade physicist, who's been our guest a couple of times, is sort of the unofficial moderator of this particular list. But also on the list is my guest, Colin Bennett, who I have learned from reading his postings there is a sharp wit, has a sharp tongue, or maybe I should say sharp keyboard, does not suffer fools, does not pull punches, displays incredibly biting humor, has a very sharp mind. He's a writer, a lecturer, a musician, a one-time mercenary. He's written a fascinating new book about the first head of Project Blue Book, Edward Rappelt, an Air Force captain who really thought he was going to get to the bottom of the UFO mystery so long ago back there in the early 1950s. Colin Bennett, a pleasure to have you here on the program.
Good evening, George. Thank you for your invitation. And good evening, America.
Why is it important to learn about Edward Rappelt? It's 50, 60 years ago. What could we learn from reading your book and studying about his life?
Well, the history of Project Blue Book is a rather neglected area of ufology, yet it's absolutely fascinating in that it expresses the views of many modern authors as concerning conspiracy, intrigue, and indeed the very strange actions of what we would take to be highly intelligent men, high officers in the Air Force, who actively resisted Operation Blue Book under Rappelt, Captain Edward Rappelt, and show the beginnings of enormously corrupt intrigue. Two high officers, for example, who opposed research into UFOs were Vandenberg, chief of staff in 1946 of the United States Air Force, and Colonel Watson, head of ATIC, Air Technical Intelligence Command, at Dayton, Ohio, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. They actively destroyed documentation. I say destroyed. Instead of writing nonsense in their opinion across the report, they destroyed it. General Vandenberg, for example, I think he was Brigadier General then, in 46, actively destroyed the report from Project Sign called Estimate of the Situation. Now, negative opinions are one thing. The Air Force is entitled to negative opinion, but active destruction of Air Force property is what we call, in the UK, a court-martial offence, particularly if you're a general rank. Now, Colonel Watson of ATIC, in the days before Rappelt, destroyed the film camera evidence or film at White Sands, and again actively destroyed. It's very, very strange that such highly intelligent and capable and well decorated officers such as Colonel Watson and General Vandenberg did such a thing instead of shrugging their shoulders and saying, "I don't believe any of this nonsense," instead of doing that and full stop. They actively destroyed evidence. Colonel Watson, for example, a very brave man, medals across his chest, a great patriot, and a fighter pilot in World War II, destroyed also the wire recording of a General Cabell meeting on UFOs, which was General Cabello at the time. He destroyed the recording. Was head of ATIC, Technical Intelligence Command, and actively destroy instrumentation as well as documentation is extraordinary. It's almost as if the UFO is a form. I mean, I'm smiling as I say this. It's a form of demoniac possession for such men to actively destroy documentation and instrumentation. Is fascinating. I mean, why do they do this?
Well,
the great mysteries of the UFO. There's a pack of sane men, capable men, highly intelligent men, actively destroy evidence.
Well, we'll definitely get into some other examples that because you'd explore those. It's not only those high-ranking guys, but it became sort of an endemic, and I want to come back to that. But I want to talk about the time period, though, first, because I'll tell you, this is the time period that got me hooked on the UFO subject so long ago. Those are late 40s, early 50s, when the military was first studying this mystery, when they were perplexed and they really wanted an answer. And mostly what interests me is that this was a time before the real significant cover-up mechanism was in place. And I don't know where you are on the whole cover-up issue, but certainly before the cone of silence sort of descended, before there was official ingrained disinformation, misinformation. And it's why I still think that the ultimate solution to the mystery, or at least clues to a better understanding, are still out there. Why I look at those early cases, because they were reported and investigated before the government and intelligence agencies could get their fangs into them and bury them somewhere.
Yes, indeed. Yes, I agree. It was a sign of a momentary sign of healthy intellectual inquiry that Blue Book was created, and it compiled the most amazing archives, which could still be seen. But Ruppelt was finally put down. And he wasn't given any assistance. He wasn't given the money required. He wasn't given facilities that he should have been given. But he did the best with what he was given. And that was quite brilliant. He established for the first time a record of UFO sightings and statistics, and placed the whole study of UFOs on a proper basis, and employed people such as the Battelle Institute to use what was then advanced methods of research using punch cards. Now, punch cards may sound rather old-fashioned, and of course it was, but it was the only computerized, semi-computerized, if you like, way of organizing statistics. This had not been done before. Ruppelt placed UFO research onto what was the beginning of a proper scientific basis. There had been attempts before in Project Grudge. You can imagine the atmosphere in which, resentful atmosphere in which the title was for UFO research, Project Grudge.
Yeah, it was Project Sign was the first project, and that became Project Grudge after, as you mentioned,
yes.
Hoyt Vandenberg said, I don't want to hear any of this nonsense.
Yes, and Project Grudge dive bombs. Bob Gina, who was a journalist at the Time magazine, when was it, 51, late 51, interviewed Lieutenant Rogers he was the one-man operation of Grudge. And all Lieutenant Rogers did was throw the reports into the waste bin. And Bob Gina of Life magazine managed to get to him and realize he was talking with a totally unintelligent and incompetent person as far as the UFO was concerned. This report got to higher echelon, and Rogers was sacked. And New Grudge instituted. And Captain Cummings, Captain Cummings, yeah, and who recruited Ruppelt as an assistant, part-time assistant. We're talking about part-time, you know, there should have been scores of people onto this, but there he's got one-man operation, Captain Cummings, and Neufeld as his part-time operation. Two men, one full-time and one part-time. But they did manage to get together, as I say, the framework at least of a study into the UFO concerning personality, concerning society, concerning the height, color, behavior, maneuvers, etc. And to try at least and collate this information so that they had a statistical picture of the UFO, which were reports were coming in all the time. But of course, they just had to pile up on a desk because there was one man operating and the group doing part-time work. But at least it was something of an attempt to place the UFO sightings on a proper basis. It was decided by Colonel Rosengarten, the head of ATIC at the time, that something had to be done about this. He was one of the good guys. And Rupert and Cummings moved on, and a properly constituted study, Project Blue Book, was established. And Rupert was given something like 8 to 10 staff members and money and a full communication suite as it existed at the time.
Colin, let's not jump ahead. Let's build a couple of steps before we get to that point. Let's talk about Ruppelt himself. Now, this guy, I mean, his story is Shakespearean. It's tragic. It breaks your
Absolutely.
Heart. But he is a heroic figure. You compare him sort of you as an observer of American culture and American archetypes. Compare him to an Ahab in a way.
Yes. Oh, certainly. Yes, he's a Shakespearean figure, and.
I mean, he wasn't.
History. Well, he was a captain in the Air Force, and he served on Tinian Island in the Pacific. Tinian was the main B-29 base for the final assault on Japan. This is 45, of course, and the B-29s. Let's just talk about horrible things for the moment. Launched a fire raid on Tokyo. And were later to carry the nuclear weapons to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Captain Ruppelt was a bombardier navigator. And somehow, even in his early life, he got involved with big historical events. He couldn't do anything but get involved with big historical events. For instance, he could have seen Enola Gay, the B-29, carrying the first atomic weapon to Hiroshima. And if someone had broken a leg in Tibbetts, B-29, the navigator say, Ruppelt might well have been taken as a replacement and heading for Hiroshima. And so, that's a big enough event for one one lifetime. And after the war, he was enlisted there. He entered civilian life as an aircraft technician. But just as he was catching his breath after the Second World War, the Korean War in 52 broke out, and he was enlisted into the Air Force again. You must remember a minor note here. It's the Air Force, it was the AA Air Force, Army Air Force in those days. In 1946, it became the officially United States Air Force. And he served under Colonel Rosengarten in ATIC and at Wright-Patterson Base, Dayton, Ohio. Excuse me a moment. Would you please be quiet? Thank you. Sorry about that, America. Anyway,
What struck me, though, is you make the note that he's not a blue blood. He's not a West Point or an Academy graduate. He's not from an old money or an old military family or anything like that. Just sort of up by the bootstraps, got himself an education as a mechanical engineer and launched into a military career. He was in World War II and then was pulled back in, right?
Yes, yes. And he was given the task at ATIC by Colonel Rosengarten of looking at the MiG-15, a Russian fighter which had been crashed and taken to the States.
It's sort of like reverse engineering of Russian technology?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. The MiG-15 was a terrible threat to the American fighter at the time, the F 86 Sabre. It had cannon, which fired explosive 37mm shells, and the Sabre had World War II machine guns. The Sabre had to get a hell of a long shot with its machine guns in order to shoot down a MiG. The MiG was a real threat. They learned never, ever to underestimate the Russians. Their T-34 tank produced a surprise to the Germans in 42-43. Sloped armor, aluminium engine, etc. And he carried this examination of the MiG-15 to such a high class degree that Colonel Rosengarten saw he had a very, very extraordinarily capable man on his hands. And he was keen to get a new UFO project started under Ruppelt.
And you note in the book that Ruppelt, and it's kind of brought a smile to my face, that Ruppelt, he is working on this MiG project, reverse engineering a Russian MiG, but he's eavesdropping on what's going on down the hallway or a few desks away where the UFO study, the other UFO study was underway.
Yes. There was, I think I mentioned a Lieutenant Rogers. Lieutenant Rogers was in charge of Grudge, and he was absolutely hopeless. Exposed in Life magazine by the reporter Bob Gina, and this was the warning that all was not well, and therefore he took Ruppelt from the MiG project, which was near completion, and gave him Project Blue Book. Ruppelt, in answer to your comment there, Ruppelt first came across the UFO when he heard Rogers guffawing with laughter and surrounded by rather supercilious people who were laughing, producing gales of laughter at every UFO report which came in. And he wondered what this laughter was all about. And he would wander three desks down from his own and listened to the scuttlebutt and found that this UFO project was a source of laughter and ridicule in a supercilious way. That was his first introduction to that thing called a UFO. And this inadequate Rogers was detected by high authority, and they got rid of him. And they launched New Grudge, still at ATIC, under Captain Cummings, with Ruppelt's part-time. So then they launched into Project Blue Book proper.
We should bring people up to date. There was the first project, the Air Force project, was called Project Sign, and that was a legitimate investigation of UFOs. They went out and gathered up a lot of great cases and did some analysis. And as you mentioned earlier, it was put into this report, this fascinating report, Estimate of the Situation, that was presented to Hoyt Vandenberg, who just could not abide by the findings that the estimation that some of these craft were interplanetary. The Air Force concluded some of them are from other planets from somewhere. And Hoyt Vandenberg said, as you noted, I can't accept this, but he ordered every copy of that report destroyed. And then he created the second study, which, as you note, is called Project Grudge, which I'd say you can infer from that name. I'll tell you what, Colin, we're going to take a brief break. When we come back, we'll get into the creation of Project Blue Book and how Edward Ruppelt gets it off and running. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Colin Bennett, author of the new book, Flying Saucers Over the White House, a sort of a biography of Captain Edward J. Ruppelt, who was the first head of Project Blue Book at a fascinating time in American history, whether you like the subject of UFOs or not. So much was going on, including some fairly dramatic UFO flaps. I mean, the kinds of UFO incidents that, if they happened today in the media age we're in now, would shake the world right to its foundation. We'll get into some of the specific examples of that, talk more about the times and what led to the creation of Project Blue Book right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Colin Bennett is my guest. He's written this new biography of Edward J. Rappelt. And Colin, why was it? You mentioned earlier that Edward Rappelt is there at ATIC. He's working on this MIG and other projects, and he is drawn to the UFO topic because he hears these guffaws, these side-splitting laughs by other officers who are working on the Air Force's UFO study. They're laughing at it. They're dismissing these cases. Tell me this. Why the laughter factor? What psychologically was going on there that these macho aviators, these combat veterans, had to resort to laughter, to nervous little giggles whenever a credible or interesting UFO case would cross their desks?
Well, I'm afraid it's still happening, even as a subject.
Sure.
Rejected largely by the general public because it's a difficult imaginative leap. You have to have a complete change of paradigm in the head if you're going to accept that intelligent maneuvering vehicles in the Earth's atmosphere are way ahead of anything we've got. People tend to suppress their worst fears. People can't accept such a big idea, and they therefore try to reduce it in some way, as if psychologically it's some kind of horror, some kind of inconceivable thing. People just have so much to take in their heads in the modern world. The idea of extraplanetary aliens visiting the Earth in intelligent and controlled vehicles is a bit too much. They tend to distance it, and I'm afraid that's the situation. I write for UFO magazine, and America, so you can get millions for a Steven Spielberg film on aliens. America could only support one magazine, UFO magazine. I mean, they don't like reading about it. It's a different experience.
You, in the Jerome Clark, who's himself a great ufologist, a good writer, a good solid researcher, he writes the introduction to your book, and he cites a section of something that you wrote about comparing it to a family sitting down to dinner each night. Do you remember that that line, that story?
Yes.
Can you tell it?
Yes.
Can you explain?
You have a kind of schizoid approach. You have a good metaphor would be a family sitting down to dinner. And a man comes out of one wall, walks through the table, and disappears into another wall. That can become accepted. We don't know what this is. We don't know what this phenomenon is. But the man appears to be quite friendly and harmless and doesn't even register our existence. So we'll let him walk through the wall. We'll let him walk through the dinner table and carry on with our dinner.
Yeah, a man walks through your dining room every night, walks through the walls. After a while, you decide, well, he's no threat to us, so we're just going to pretend he's not there, which is what has essentially happened with our military. UFOs are no threat, therefore we're not going to look at them anymore.
That's exactly it, yeah. So you still get, in many UFO research organizations, reports by Air Force pilots. They're still piling up and being analyzed. And yet the Air Force killed Blue Book long before 1968, and finally carved its gravestone in terms of the Condon Report, which rejected all UFOs as regards any kind of reality. There were hallucinations, mistakes, pieces of silliness. This is a report, big report, carried out by the very, very skeptical Dr. Edward Condon. I'll pronounce that again very carefully, Condon.
Yes.
And that was it. If you write, that was the end of the UFO as far as the United States Air Force is concerned.
And science.
If you write to the Air Force today asking innocently about their UFO report, you will get a standard reply. We ceased all UFO reporting in 1968, a long time ago, and we no longer carry any information about UFOs. You get a standard slip from the Pentagon, and that's saying that, and they would deny having anything to do with UFO reports. Absolutely amazing for a brilliant organization, the United States Air Force, which is spread throughout the planet and is on the cutting edge of research in the civilian sector, and it can't handle the idea of ufology or UFOs. It's amazing. It's a kind of cultural schizophrenia in which you have all these brilliant men and women in Air Force communications and research, and yet the Air Force says UFOs don't exist.
As you note, what makes it even more astonishing is that these people are in the information business. They're the intelligence arm of the Air Force, who presumably would keep a file basically forever so they could analyze it, if not now, then later. You mentioned, but in fact, that they threw this stuff away.
I'm sorry, would you say that again, Peter?
But as you mentioned, they in fact threw this stuff away. Let's talk about the estimate of the situation as a source of the ridicule factor. They create this excellent report. Hoyt Vandenberg orders every copy to be destroyed. Do you know what was in it? Do you have a basic idea what you think was in it?
Ruppelt himself hints, only hints, that a few copies survived. And apparently, the Project Sign report called Estimate of the Situation recorded fantastic. Their main thesis was the recording of fantastic performances by your observed UFOs from service personnel, and there were high quality reports, radar intersections, and ground observer reports. And indeed, film footage, early film footage the Sands Proving Ground.
White Sands,
they can't be produced. The conclusion of the report was that these UFO effects and observations cannot be possibly. The expression of aircraft technology as it stood in, I think it's 48, it's a very early report, Project Sign. And you just have to, in the face of the evidence, you just have to accept that this is a very great possibility. They don't go into talk about aliens, that was much later. But the mere effect that you have vehicles, intelligence and control, maneuvering out of the way of fighter aircraft, performing often comic maneuvers about fighter aircraft and bombers, which of course in 48 they were nearly all, or certainly propeller-driven aircraft. And it contained a conclusion that since we're not making these things are vehicles. Technological pieces of certain kinds of apparatus. They obey certain laws, the observed laws. Their speeds were just incredible as compared with humble 1948 American aircraft, military aircraft. Moreover, the reports, of course, were not confined to America. There were worldwide reports. Many different flying organizations were beginning to report them. And a massive document was compiled called Estimate of the Situation. But the man in charge, he was the chief of staff of the Air Force then. Am I coming through loud and clear?
Yes. Yes, you are.
He destroyed him. The very man who, this is apart from the mystery of the UFO. You have the mystery of people, Air Force officers of the highest rank, destroying things. So you've got a very, very interesting psychological, social, cultural element to UFO studies, which is worth worthy of study in itself. In many conspiracy theorists have written about this side, and the shelves grown with their books. No one can understand it.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm concluding this thesis here.
Sure.
That no one can understand active destruction. I mean, whose side are they on? We're talking about big people here. You know, Vandenberg became the head of the Air Force, damn it. And if the head of the Air Force is going to destroy Air Force documentation, he's risking prosecution. Would you risk prosecution on such a premise because you destroyed Air Force property when you were a general anyway? You should have been hit with prosecution or given a warning. You know, where is this documentation? And who was supervising him? So I don't pretend to understand, but I do know that it's a very interesting psychological side to the UFO phenomenon. It still occurs.
Let's talk about that time period, though. You know, if you think about the kinds of UFO, what you call flaps, what the term is called flaps, where you have a whole outbreak of sightings, some of them very dramatic, involving, you know, seen by tens of thousands of people. I mean, that was a period of several of these, which, of course, caught the attention of the Air Force and everyone else. And can you imagine what those kinds of flaps, if they were to occur today when we have so many cell phone cameras and surveillance systems, and how the impact would be versus back then?
Well, the impact was tremendous because you had at least a minimal Air Force response in those days. It was a minimal response, but in terms of Rupert's organization, Blue Book, minimal, but at least it was a response. As to think from a complete denial and put down of Condon in 1968. So it not only destroyed evidence, it destroyed its own Air Force research organization. Because when Rupert left the Air Force, it was taken over, Blue Book was taken over by a desperate yes man. Colonel Hector Quintilla, who merely... His task was to reduce his one man. It was reduced from 8 men to 1 man. And by that, after Rupert left, it was reduced to 1 man. The forces of destruction were moving in terms of Quintilla. And all Quintilla did was gradually reduce Blue Book operation to passive filing cabinets, gathering dust in the corner of an office somewhere. That was his achievement.
Well, before we get that far, let's talk about when Rupelt is given the assignment, when Blue Book is created. He jumps in with both feet. He's encouraged. He thinks he's really going to get to conduct an actual investigation, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, oh, that's right. Yeah. His tech chief, Colonel Rosengarten, is quite enthusiastic. And at one time, Rupelt's team consisted of 10 staff. Who journeyed all over America gathering evidence, and which was categorized, organized, and was a highly successful attempt at getting UFO information, if on a small scale. There were incredible reports coming in of Sabre pilots reporting silver discs. It was always silver discs. And these silver discs would stop in front of the fighter, fighter, and laugh at it. The Sabre pilots would increase speed, and the discs would shoot ahead straight into an area which wasn't really investigated in those days, the area of Mach 1, M-A-C-H. And there were no supersonic aircraft in the U.S. Air Force at the time Rupelt was running Blue Book. None at all. I mean, they were beginning to, you know, I mean, and under Chuck Yeager and all the research that was going on to get near the Mach 1 envelope. But there was no actual supersonic aircraft in action anywhere. And they were limited to 600 miles an hour for all kinds of test rigs. But the Air Force didn't have a supersonic fighter in these days. It had the Sabre, and later on the F-100, which was near Mach 1, but not quite. And these just shot off into the Mach 1 region without any sonic booms being reported, which, you know, gave thoughts to what kind of material are these discs composed on? I mean, what kind of material goes through the Mach 1 envelope and doesn't make a sonic boom? It gave forth to many a thought that they've got some incredible, they've built some incredible material, and then they would vanish. They would swoop into the Mach 1 area, and then disappear, and then appear again, as if someone had switched on the light. It was Rupert's conclusion that you had here, a fantastic reality imposed upon a fantastic reality. And that's where the fear came from. How advanced are these? Given that they're advanced, how advanced are these damn UFOs? You know, could they kill the entire Air Force in an hour? They began to get cold feet. They began to be very frightened. And perhaps that's the reason why they destroyed evidence. It was making the Western culture look small. And I think that was one of the main reasons why, you know, so many in the Air Force ridiculed and tried to get rid of the UFO.
Well, outline and describe some really dramatic cases that were investigated by the Air Force both before and after and during Blue Book, and we'll get into some of those. What they tend to show, though, especially prior to Ruppelt taking over the investigation, is how incredibly disorganized our intelligence, Air Force intelligence, was. It was shameful that they were unable to communicate internally, let alone externally.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Ruppelt had many, many enemies. People, for some peculiar reason, hated the UFO. They were also jealous of this very, very capable young man taking over the project. I think there was just very human jealousy and envy there about the project, about this, what was, of course, at that time, an explosive project. UFOs? What is ATIC talking about? They wouldn't accept evidence, even if it was put in front of them, you know, and towed by elephants. They shut off. And this is, again, I mentioned this. This is an intriguing psychological aspect. Social scientific aspect of the phenomenon. People react, ordinary people, going about their jobs, very efficient people, very intelligent people, highly decorated airmen with nerves of steel, are destroying evidence or denying its existence. It's clear. Yeah, I mean, it really is.
Well. As I mentioned, there's some very dramatic cases and encounters with between warplanes and UFOs that I want to get into. In particular, this is something I had not read about before, is these sightings and encounters experienced by people working with these high air balloons. Some of them were I guess, in these little kind of cups underneath these high air balloons, and saw some dramatic stuff. We'll get into that and a lot more with my guest, Colin Bennett, right after this on Coast to Coast AM.